WRCT Pittsburgh, your Oil Revival station.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio. And Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a recent New York Times story about Senate Energy Committee Chair Joe Manchin's conflicts of interest quoted a source that said, "It says something fascinating about our politics that we're going to have a representative of fossil fuel interests crafting the policy that reduces our emissions from fossil fuels." Well, a lot of people would say that's less fascinating than horrific, and particularly in the context of a new global survey of people between 16 and 25 that found that more than half of them believe humanity is doomed, and that 58% of those young people said their governments are betraying them. You really can't talk about why we can't get to realistic climate policy without talking about that betrayal and its roots. And that's why we're going to talk about Joe Manchin in particular with David Moore, co-founder of the investigative news outlet Sludge. Also on the show, you may have heard that more than 2,000 Americans a day are dying from COVID. That has not stopped the misinformation and misdirection from mainstream media. We'll get an update on media coverage of COVID from FAIR's editor, Jim Narikas. That's all coming up. But first, we'll take a real quick look back at some media coverage. A September 22nd Chicago Sun-Times report declared in its headline, and we know many people don't read past that, that former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's nomination to be ambassador to Japan, quote, "has no significant opposition," close quote. Well, as noted by FAIR Associate and Roots Action Director Norman Solomon in a letter to the Sun-Times and to reporter Lynn Sweet, that is wildly and meaningfully inaccurate. It erases the vocal opposition from dozens of groups, including Code Pink, the American Friends Service Committee, Demand Progress, Jewish Voice for Peace Action, Veterans for Peace, along with a long list of bereaved Chicagoans who object to Emanuel's elevation based on, to be polite, ethics, integrity, and diplomatic skills. There's nothing like hearing that your political involvement turns up in media as not significant to make you understand that corporate news media are not and should not be the arbiters of political significance. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. A couple months ago, FAIR's Julie Holler.
I'm FAIR the Deliberate Stranger, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
The COVID pandemic in the United States is becoming more and more politically red. A year ago, we wondered, would this happen? And then 6 months ago, we said this will probably happen. And then 3 months ago, we said the data is showing that this is starting to actually happen. But now it's not only completely undeniable, the degree to which in the United States, COVID has become a Republican killer, a Republican virus disproportionately, is quite stunning. And overwhelmingly, the COVID deaths are happening in counties that Donald Trump won. And presumably, logically, overwhelmingly, it is Trump voters who are dying from COVID at much higher rates than Biden voters. Now, would it be enough to influence an election at a congressional district level in a state? Federally, really still a question mark in terms of the math. But as we've looked at with hypothetical numbers from Florida a few months ago, if this continues to be disproportionately a virus that kills Republicans in the United States because Republicans are disproportionately unvaccinated, it actually could come to make a difference, for example, in something like the Florida gubernatorial election. It's a bit of a stretch, but it's possible. But let's look at the numbers that we have now first. The New York Times has a really good piece on this, which shows how the partisan gap has grown and grown and grown since January 1st, where it was only slightly more likely in January that the COVID deaths were in the Trump counties rather than the Biden counties. Now, remember, this is a chart of COVID death rates. So for people saying, well, there's more people or fewer people. No. This is the rate per 100,000 people. In January, there was a slightly higher rate of death in Trump voting counties than Biden counties. That gap has spread and spread starting around mid-September. It has increased dramatically to the point where now, as you can see here, the cumulative death rate is under 200 deaths per 100,000 people in Biden counties. And it is rapidly approaching 300 deaths per 100,000 people in Trump counties. That is a huge, huge difference. Now, there have been many attempts, I guess I would call them, by various right wingers of different stripes to explain this difference away by saying, well, the difference is weather in those places, or the difference is age in these places, in Trump versus Biden counties. But when you examine the data, it's not supported by fact. And as it's pointed out in the New York Times article about these numbers, if the difference was due to weather or age, we would have seen that partisan split last year. But instead, we are seeing a dramatic increase in that partisan split over the last few months. What we are seeing is a shift in what determines who is most likely to die. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. At the start of the pandemic, we've talked about this now, we've said this before, the deaths were most likely to be happening in the places that had, we would call it, the misfortune of being early infection sites because of the direct flights to and from the early infected regions of China and some countries in Europe like Italy. So you had New York, New Jersey. You had Boston with that early conference and many nonstop flights to Asia, for example, and a few other spots. That early, that was what indicated who was getting hit the hardest. We now have a very different situation. We now know about how the virus spreads. We now have it everywhere, so to speak. And we now have vaccination widely available. And now the biggest distinguishing factor between the Trump counties and the Biden counties is the level of vaccination. 40% of Republican adults are not vaccinated. Only 10% of Democratic registered adults are unvaccinated. That is why the COVID deaths are concentrated not in major metropolitan areas, but rather on a rate basis. Remember, we're talking about a rate of death. The deaths are increasingly concentrated where conservatives tend to live, more suburban and rural areas, because they have a far lower rate of vaccination. Now, it doesn't just apply to deaths. If you look at cases, we are seeing a big partisan gap there as well. It was biggest in August. And now, thanks to the national decline in COVID cases, although the last 10 days make us wonder whether cases are going to go back up, we now see still a partisan gap on cases, but a slightly smaller one than we had in August. So COVID is getting more and more politically red. It's not a surprising thing that we are seeing this increasingly ravage Republicans at this point in time. And there's a good chance, I mean, even when we say, look at the death rate in this Biden county, it stands to reason that because Republicans are disproportionately unvaccinated, that even in Biden counties, the deaths happening there skew towards the Republican Party. So in every country is different. In the United States, we increasingly are seeing this as a Republican pandemic. Does it mean liberals can't die? Of course not. The virus doesn't discriminate on the basis of politics. However, vaccination is the greatest indicator as to where we are seeing the virus kill more versus fewer people. And it is Republicans who are disproportionately unvaccinated. So we're going to keep following these numbers, but it is a trend we expected. It's the trend we started to see. And the degree to which we are now seeing it is quite stunning. Do Republicans care, even if they don't care about the people that are dying? Maybe they don't. Maybe they do. I don't know. You'd have to ask them. At some point, don't you think that they would wake up and say, hey, this is killing our voters more than it is killing their voters? And merely from the perspective of like a pragmatic election strategy, at some point you would imagine they would start saying, hey, you know, I mean, like, this isn't good. Maybe we should go and get ourselves vaccinated. Hey, this is something very interesting. I want to be really careful about what I say because I want to protect people's privacy here. A Fox News executive has leaked some documents to me about Fox News's vaccine policy and vaccine reporting requirements. And Fox News is really, really strict. Even though on air, Fox News has made a huge deal out of attacking vaccine requirements and protocols and mandates or whatever you call them. And even though Fox hosts on air have said, we don't have a mandate here, we have a protocol, even though it's a stricter protocol than the one outlined by Joe Biden. They behind the scenes are really taking this seriously. And Fox News has an insanely high vaccination rate. Why? Because vaccine requirements work, as we've said before. So we've gone at it. We've been asked by this Fox executive who's sick of what's going on there. This is stunning stuff. We've been asked by them to remove any personally identifying information, which I have done. OK, so let's look at this information. First, I got an email today from this Fox executive who said, David, I joined today at joinpacman.com. I am a longtime Fox employee. I am in management at Fox, and I am disgusted with the lies and misinformation. Honestly, Hannity and especially Tucker deserve a kick in the nuts. You can say nuts. That word is allowed. They make me sick. The lies that they are allowed to spread are sick. My political and philosophical views pretty much match up with yours to a T. I've been listening for about 3 to 4 months. I used to not care about politics, but the Trump years and the pandemic made me a hardcore resister of Trump MAGA. Racism, lies, COVID, and vaccine misinformation of Fox make me really angry. If I could afford to lose my job, I would say something, but they pay me well and the insurance is excellent. Fox took COVID seriously. I worked on site through the pandemic. They paid all my insurance premiums for the entire pandemic. See below. Please don't use my name or email, but feel free to contact me if you wish. I would call your voicemail, but I don't want anyone to recognize my voice. I will help if I can. I hate what Fox has done and what they have allowed to happen with Tucker and his Patriot purge. Keep up the good work and reach out to me if you like. You can talk about this if you like. Keep my name out of it, please. Also, my email address. Thanks for what you do. Keep up the fight, my friend. Regards. See below, Fox mentions insurance premiums below, and then a screenshot of the COVID policy. This is very interesting. This is someone in Fox management. Very, very interesting. So check out some of the things that they sent to me. And these are fascinating. COVID policy email. Check this out. As we have said, as we have through the pandemic, Fox is following the guidance and policies of the CDC, as well as state and local jurisdictions, with mask wearing and social distancing requirements for fully vaccinated individuals being lifted in nearly all the areas where we operate. Fox has made several important updates to our COVID protocols as described below. For us to provide the most flexibility to our employees, we strongly encourage everyone who has been fully vaccinated to upload vaccination information into Workday instructions for how to do that. So they have a not only a vaccine protocol, they have a vaccine reporting protocol.
Oh, what about HIPAA? What about hippo? What about rhino and giraffe and all of these things that are supposedly being violated per the Fox hosts, as they say on air? Well, Fox is doing it. Fox is saying you got to upload the proof, my friends. Fully vax. OK, the new policies effective immediately are as follows. Fully vaccinated employees who have uploaded status into Workday and it has been verified by HR are not required to wear a mask or socially distance when at work. Employees are considered fully vaccinated 2 weeks after their second dose in a two-dose series or 2 weeks after a single dose. However, keep in mind some work sites, off-party and third parties have different requirements. Okay, fully vaccinated individuals who have entered their vaccination info into Workday and it has been verified by HR will be provided a Fox Clear Pass. Oh my God, is that like a Star of David per those protesters who were putting the yellow stars on them saying this is what it is when you have to prove your status? Well, Fox is doing it, folks. Fox is doing it. You will have to and it goes on to say you have to do a screening process each day that you go to work. Each day you go to work. All right. Unvaccinated employees or people who simply have not provided their vaccination info are going to have to continue to complete the daily screening. Note, employees who may be fully vaccinated but who have not entered their info will be considered unvaccinated. So you not only have to be vaccinated, but you have to prove your vaccination, which many of these anti-requirement, anti-mandate, anti-protocol people, including on Fox's airwaves, are against. Because it is medical apartheid. It's OK. You guys remember all the things they said. Here's another fascinating message. This was an email from the office of Kevin Lord. Dear colleagues, following our request for employees to upload their vaccination status in our secure system, we are pleased to share more than 90% of our full time employees reported they are fully vaccinated. Wow, it worked. This is important information as we continue to implement phased return to office timing and procedures. Soon, we will introduce another health and safety measure, daily COVID testing, stricter than Biden's proposal, for the small group of employees not vaccinated or who have not provided vaccination status. So again, on air, what Biden is doing is terrible. Behind the scenes, even stricter, even stricter. Here's one more, which is fascinating. On June 22nd, 2021, FTS issued an email for new COVID protocols. As you know, we have been following the guidance of the CDC, et cetera. However, to optimize our efforts to maintain a safe workplace, we strongly encourage everyone who has been fully vaccinated to upload vaccine info to Workday. Attached are instructions. Additionally, you will need to provide HR with a copy or photo of your COVID vaccination record card for verification. Fully vaccinated employees who enter the information into Workday will get a Fox Clear Pass permanent green screen, which you must show to security every day. Unvaccinated employees or those who don't get the Fox Clear Pass must continue to do a daily screening as required, must continue to wear a face mask, and continue to social distance. As an employer, Fox News is taking this very seriously. You wouldn't know it from watching the segments on air in the morning on Fox and Friends, midday with people like Bill Hemmer and others, Dana Perino, whoever, at night watching Laura Ingraham and Tucker and Hannity. But behind the scenes, it is one of the strictest policies we've seen. Thank you to that Fox News management individual who has leaked these documents to us. We're going to go out of our way to protect their privacy. But understand that what you are seeing on air does not even come close to matching what's happening behind the scenes. Find me on Twitter at @DPacman. We're going to take a quick break and be back right after this. In the United States, we have due process. We are innocent until proven guilty. That is a good thing. That is not something I would ever seek to change or violate or argue against. But as a program that is just based on my opinion on things, sometimes I give you my opinion of people's behavior. And sometimes people's behavior is not indicative of them being innocent. Now, courts adjudicate guilt versus lack of guilt. They don't adjudicate innocence. And that is the standard that applies in courts. Donald Trump's behavior continues colloquially without violating anyone's due process, without saying Trump should be charged or convicted of any crime, just observing his behavior as a human. It is not the behavior of an innocent person. And we are now learning about Donald Trump's latest, another attempt, the latest attempt to block January 6th investigators from getting access to information about what the hell he was up to in the days leading up to and during the Trump riots. There is a very interesting Politico article. And even actually, the article is called Trump Makes and Loses Overnight Bid to Block January 6th Investigators. Ron Filipkowski, who's doing a great job covering this stuff, tweeted this morning, in an odd move late last night, Trump filed an emergency motion to block documents from the National Archives from being turned over to congressional investigators this Friday. Odd, because the judge hasn't even ruled yet on his previous objection. This is not the behavior of an innocent person or someone with nothing to hide. Going to the Politico article, if you blinked, you missed it. Former President Trump filed an emergency request to a federal judge late Monday night, last night, to prevent the National Archives from sending sensitive records to the January 6th committee investigators by Friday. And just after midnight, Judge Tanya Chutkan rejected it, contending the request itself was legally defective and premature. Not shocking after the 4 years we had of Trump's the people around Trump making invalid legal arguments in various courts that it is continuing. The unusual exchange happened in a span of 2 hours, and it came as Chutkan is already considering an earlier request by Trump to prevent Congress from peering into his White House's records about his attempt to overturn the 2020 election. Trump sued to block the archives from turning the records over last month after Joe Biden declined to assert executive privilege on his behalf. We covered that at the time. The archives indicate it would turn the papers over to lawmakers by Friday unless a court intervened. Chutkan heard arguments in the suit last week, promised to rule quickly on the initial emergency request from Trump. She seemed inclined to reject it, questioning the legal basis for a former president to claim executive privilege over records when the sitting president and Congress disagree. The archives indicated Trump is seeking to block at least 750 pages out of an initial 1500 unearthed in response to the January 6th committee's request for records about Trump's attempt to overturn the election. Many of the papers are called from the files of senior Trump aides like Mark Meadows, Stephen Miller, and Patrick Philbin. They also include, this is important, call and visitor logs. Who was Trump speaking to in the days leading up to leaving office and leading up to the Trump riots? And who was visiting Trump at the White House in those same important days? Trump's attorney Jesse Binnell issued his second request Monday night, asking Chutkan to approve an administrative stay of her own ruling even before she issued it. That way, Binnell argued, Trump would have a chance to appeal her decision before the archives began delivering hundreds of pages to congressional investigators. So again, Trump hasn't been charged with any crimes. I'm not saying he should be. I'm not saying that any jury should rule anyway. Every time we do this, I get emails from right wingers saying, David, don't you believe in due process? Don't you believe until innocent until proven guilty? Not only do I believe in those things, my belief in those things is irrelevant to the fact that that is the system we have in the justice system. This is not the justice system here. This is not about guilt or innocence. This is about Donald Trump's attempt to block records from being given to the committee. And it is not, colloquially speaking, my opinion and that of many in my audience from the emails I'm getting, this is not the behavior of an innocent person. This is not the behavior of someone with nothing to hide. So we are going to continue to follow this, and we will see if and when these documents ultimately get to the January 6th commission, what they uncover. Now, as a reminder, much like with the debate about Trump's tax records and the legal wrangling around it, this is about the release of these documents to the January 6th committee. It is not about their public release. So it's not like if the judge says we're not stopping it, we get access to these documents. We might if they leak or are subsequently released, but it is at least in the immediate just about releasing these documents to those investigating the January 6th riots. Just a reminder, they might leak. I would not encourage that leaking, but if they leaked, I would certainly look at them. Let's put it that way. We have new reporting from ABC's Jonathan Karl, which reveals that Donald Trump actually threatened the Republican Party with leaving the Republican Party on January 20th as he was flying out on Air Force One for the last time. These are unbelievable details from Jonathan Karl in his new book. This is a book in which the book is called Betrayal, the Final Act of the Trump Show. And in the book, Karl reports that Trump went to the GOP chairwoman, the chairwoman of the Republican Party, and said on January 20th, I'm leaving the party and I'm creating my own party. And I don't care if this destroys the Republican Party. Now, Trump hasn't done that. And the book recounts that Trump ultimately backed down, but only when Republican leaders threatened Trump with what really hurts him, which is his finances. That's really ultimately what Donald Trump cares about. Now, the details of the incident are unbelievable. This reportedly took place on January 20th on Air Force One, as Donald Trump was quite literally taking his final flight out as president of the United States. Here's a quote from Jonathan Karl's book. RNC chairwoman Ronna McDaniel called to wish him farewell. It was a very unpleasant conversation. Donald Trump was in no mood for small talk or nostalgic goodbyes, Karl writes. He got right to the point. He told her he was leaving the Republican Party and would be creating his own political party. The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., was also on the phone. The younger Trump had been relentlessly denigrating the Republican National Committee for being insufficiently loyal to Trump. In fact, at the January 6th rally before the Capitol riot, the younger Trump all but declared that the old Republican Party didn't exist anymore. It then got very real with the following exchange. Quote, I'm done, Trump told McDaniel. I'm starting my own party. You cannot do that, McDaniel told Trump. If you do, we will lose forever. To which Trump responded, exactly. You lose forever without me. I don't care. This is what Republicans deserve for not sticking up for me. McDaniel said, this isn't what the people who depended on you deserve. The people who believed in you. You'll ruin your legacy. You'll be done. But Trump said he didn't care, Karl writes. So, first of all, the party wasn't loyal to me, Trump says. What he means by that is they didn't do enough, as he sees it, to steal an election that he lost back. They didn't execute the coup that Donald Trump wanted executed. Joe Biden won, and the Republican Party, as Trump sees it, should have figured out a way to give him another 4 years in the White House anyway. So that's what's at issue here, which is it's mind-blowingly childish. So a few different things. Number one, this is completely on brand for Donald Trump. There's nothing surprising that this is Trump is a if I've got to leave the sandbox, I'm going to poop in it so that nobody else can play in it. I'm going to shut the whole thing down. Number two, it confirms that Donald Trump doesn't care about people who he sees as no longer being useful to him. So this applied to his supporters. This applied to donors who he fleeced, claiming the money's going to go to recounts and audits and all these different things. And it applies to elected officials as well. If you're not going to, or you're going to refuse to, or whatever, to steal the election for me, you're no longer useful to me either. Neither is the party, so I'll just leave. And number three, it also confirms that Republicans are essentially Trump's accomplices. They may privately believe whatever about Donald Trump, and some of them obviously don't like Trump. Some we know and some haven't said it publicly, but it makes sense that some of them don't like Trump. But they begged him to stay rather than leave, and they recognize the damage that Trump could do. I don't think Ronna McDaniel is wrong. If Trump did start his own party, at least in 22 and 24, he could single-handedly lead to Republicans losing everything and losing badly by siphoning off a portion of the Republican electorate, creating three-way races, which Democrats unilaterally win. And then number four, it also confirms that Trump in the future is going to do what he sees as best for himself. It might be bad for the Republican Party. Trump was not a Republican much of his life. He concocted this whole Republican persona in order to run. And we've talked about that before. And Trump is going to continue doing what's best for him. And it might conflict with what's best for the Republican Party. If Trump might do something next year or the year after that would be bad for the Republican Party, not only should we let him do it, we should encourage him to do it. If he followed through with this threat, the left would be in a far better position going into 22 and 24. Trump did not ultimately leave the Republican Party because at the end of the day, he accepted and recognized and agreed that it would be bad for him financially to do that. Trump has never really been a Republican. Trump serves his interests. He has his own agenda. That's all he cares about. And right now, he seems to be trying to keep his stranglehold on the Republican Party because he knows that he needs their money if he wants to run in 24. And at least for now, he has more to gain by remaining a power player in the Republican Party than by abandoning it. Because remember, if Trump abandons the Republican Party and starts his own, it's bad for Republicans, but it's also probably a losing bet for Trump. It's really best for Democrats and the left to the extent that the left is existing within the Democratic Party. As soon as and if it becomes clear to Trump that it would be good for him to do that financially and from a PR standpoint, he will do it. The guy doesn't care. And just incredible, incredible stories here in Jonathan Carl's forthcoming book, which I think might be out next week or the week after. We'll have more on this on the David Pakman Show Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show on Instagram. You can also find me on Instagram at David.Pakman. It's great to welcome back to the program Chris Hadnagy, the founder and CEO of Social Engineer LLC, and also an adjunct professor of social engineering for the University of Arizona. Also author of the book Human Hacking, Win Friends, Influence People, and Leave Them Better Off for Having Met You. Chris, always great to talk to you.
Oh, great to talk to you too again, David.
So many might recognize Win Friends and Influence People. It's a reference to the great Dale Carnegie book. Sort of really should be. It's important reading, I feel like, for everybody. It contains a lot of interesting information. What is the connection between the title of your book and the Dale Carnegie book?
So I love that book, right? I really do. And like you said, I think it should be required reading in school because it has so many great principles in it. But if some of us don't know, it was written in the 1930s.
Right.
So it's a really old book. And it's just like a homage to Carnegie and saying, hey, I have some new principles that we can use, some new techniques for the modern era that are all taken from my work as a social engineer. And let's see how we could keep that same principle he had, being kind to people, really getting to know them, learning how to communicate, but bring it to the 21st century. So it's really an ode to him.
And in the past, you and I have talked about different ways in which social engineering can be used. I guess I would say for bad, in the sense of used to scam people, used to defeat physical security, and you work in testing physical security and cybersecurity at different companies, et cetera. But there's also sort of like another side to social engineering, which is simply like better understanding how to get along with people, how to relate to people, et cetera. There's a flip side to it.
There is. And it was only after I was doing that part, the security part, for about a decade that I said, I wonder what happens if I just use this same thing I did to break in this building, but do it when I'm at the checkout line, or if I'm just waiting for coffee, or I'm at a store and somebody's angry, can I diffuse that situation? And I just started trying these things little by little, and without manipulating people, without having to force someone into doing something they didn't want to do, I found that you can communicate with people and get almost anything you want just by being nice, kind, and empathetic. And that's how this book came about.
I've said to people on my show before and in other circumstances that one of the experiences that most sort of leveled up my ability to build rapport and relate to people was working in sales at the now defunct electronics chain Circuit City, where I started when I was 16 years old. And you had all sorts of different people coming in, many already angry because of some bad experience they had, you know, people who want to, they don't know whether you can actually help them figure out what laptop to buy for their kid or whatever the case may be. It's an incredibly valuable skill to have, to know how to very quickly relate to people and build rapport. Can you talk about sort of some of the principles? And again, we're not talking about manipulating people. We're just talking about relating to people.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important point, that last point you brought up, because that's why at the very end of that title, I put, and leave them feeling better for having met you.
Right.
Because the mission is, you can go out and use these principles for bad. You can. And you can manipulate people. You can get them to do things they don't want to do. But if you leave that one thought in your head, which is, anything I do right now, I'm going to make sure you feel better when we're done interacting, that you're going to go, man, that was a great conversation. I like that guy.
Right.
If I do that, then I'm not going to manipulate you. Right. So let's just think of Robert Cialdini's principles of influence. We could take one. Right. Let's use liking. Liking is an easy one. Right. So he makes this statement that people like people who are like them, and people like people who like them. So I can fake it and I can be all nice to you and smiley. But then later on, you hear me go, oh, man, I really hate that guy. And now you feel bad. You don't feel good. So then you're like, oh, he manipulated me. He got me to do something and he didn't even like me. That's not cool. Or I can learn to say, I'm going to pick something out about this person I don't know, and I'm going to be interested in them. And I really am. And I'm going to want to know more about you. And you're going to tell me about that. Now, later on, you're going to think, man, I met this great guy at that coffee shop and we had an amazing conversation for complete strangers. And it's that simple, where you can use that same principle. You can manipulate someone, or you can change the way you communicate and you can influence someone and really communicate in a more holistic way, building rapport and making friends that may be short term or long term. But either way, you walk away with an amazing interaction with a complete stranger.
Now, I think that there are many, I know in my audience, but out there in the general public, who they hear this conversation or they read Dale Carnegie's book and they say, I'm an introvert. This stuff doesn't work for me. This is horrifying. These are the last types of things that I want to be doing. And we do see actually that in CEOs, for example, introversion is underrepresented relative to the general population. There's a question, right, as to how, you know, sort of that. What about that? What about the fact that for a lot of people, this entire way of thinking about relating to others is just very unappetizing?
Yeah, that's an awesome question, because my COO at Social Engineer, he is a massive introvert. And we always talk about this because he's one of the leading social engineers. And, you know, he goes and breaks into buildings, communicates with people, does all this stuff. We always talk about, okay, how do you do this? How do you get there? So the first step is you have to, as an introvert, you have to have a desire to change. Right. And you really do. It has to be from you. It can't be because I tell you to do it, or, you know, they hear something on a show. That has to be like, okay, look, I just want to try something new, because it's that desire to step out of your comfort zone. That is the first step. Now, where I see a lot of people who are introverts fail is they hear this conversation and they go, okay, I'm going to go out and do it. And they pick the whole thing, right? I'm going to go out and do this whole thing. And now it's scary. Maybe they fail a little and then they go, ah, I knew I couldn't do it. Don't do that. Pick one thing. Say, hey, today when I go into Starbucks, I'm going to get one person's first name. That's it. Start small. So I'm going to get one person's first name. So now I'm standing in line and you're in front of me and I'm an introvert. And I go, hey, is that the new iPhone? You know, I was thinking of upgrading. Do you like that? What, you know, is it good? Do you have any problems with it? And they'll talk your ear off. And then you go, man, thanks. Hey, I'm Chris. You shake my hand, go, I am Dave. Great. Now we could part ways. And I accomplished that one goal. I asked you a question. I got your first name. Now, next time, say, now I'm going to get someone's full name, right? And you give yourself little incremental steps instead of saying, I'm going to go do this whole thing. And what you'll find is eventually it will get easier and easier. But if you're not naturally a person who likes to just go out and talk to strangers, then don't throw yourself in the deep end, right? You start swimming. You stay where you can stand still. So
now
do it little.
The flip side of this, in thinking about your expertise in fishing and vishing and, you know, all these different things, is sometimes the reason people get sucked into scams is because the person who's scamming them has exactly the skills that you're talking about, right?
Yes.
They're hey, that was a great experience. I ended up feeling good about that. I like this person. They seem trustworthy. So what about the other side, which is being equipped to protect yourself from people who may do exactly the things you're saying, but with subterfuge, so to speak.
Yes. No, that's an awesome question. So here's what I tell people, because sometimes I'll hear people give suggestions for protection, but they make us not human.
Mm.
And we can't do that. We can't. I mean, first of all, you can't control your emotional output. You're a person. So if you feel fear, or if you feel happy, or if you see someone that you think is attractive, your body's going to react in a way, and you're not going to be able to control it. Right?
Right.
So what I tell people is if you could stay self-aware in a conversation, and when I start to feel emotional about something, whatever that emotion is, happy, fear, sadness, whatever, to analyze quickly, is what I'm being asked to do next dangerous or not? Right. So let's say I'm the introvert standing in line with my brand new iPhone.
Yeah.
And you come up behind me and you're the introvert that's going to have a talk with me. And you say, hey, is that the brand new iPhone? Like, I was thinking of upgrading and I don't really want to talk to you. But I'm now self-aware and I go, why would he ask me that? But you said, oh, he's going to try to upgrade. Okay, well, what you're asking me is not anything dangerous. So I go, yeah, this is the new iPhone. And now if you said, hey, can I hold it? Can I see it? Now, I don't know. I feel a little weird, right? Why is a stranger asking me to hand you my phone? So I'm like, well, I don't really feel comfortable with that with COVID and everything. Sorry. But, you know, I'll show it to you. Now I could be self-aware with that and say, you know, I don't feel comfortable with that level of interaction. But you're just asking me about my phone. You're not asking me for my phone number or credit cards or anything. Then I can continue that conversation. So it's a matter of staying self-aware during the conversation to make sure you don't give anything out that could put you in danger.
And that's exactly, I feel like, and I'm curious to see what you think, that's exactly what the good scammer social engineer is probably good at, which is maybe even delaying the asks that raise red flags. Yeah. Until enough trust has been built where the mark would say, I don't know, it's been an hour. I've known this person for a month and it's all been fine. So and maybe that's where the difficulty comes with the more sophisticated scams.
True. And, you know, I just read a story. It was about a couple months ago. This poor widowed woman lost $114,000 in a romance scam. Mm. It didn't happen overnight. You know, they were, quote unquote, dating online. And this guy took her for a couple thousand, 5,000, then 10,000, and incrementally got more and more and more. A year or so into it, she's out $114,000, this poor woman. So you're right. They build the relationship, because the principle of influences that we talked about before from Cialdini or Rapport, you will give more to someone who you trust more.
Right.
So they can't come up to you and say, hey, Dave, give me $114K. And you're like, heck no, man. But if all of a sudden we're best friends, you know, we're like blood brothers and you trust me with everything. Well, maybe now you would part with that if I really need it and you have it. So they wait to build that relationship to do the ask.
Hey, to talk about something from the last sort of year and a half related to all of this. What are we seeing in terms of scamming and phishing, et cetera, related to COVID? I mean, the one thing I've seen is calls, sort of like the Social Security calls, but related to the COVID stimulus. We were seeing that for a little while.
Yeah.
But it's sort of just a version of something we've seen before. What else are we seeing?
So because this is such a global thing, normally when we see some kind of catastrophe, it's very localized, like a, you know, the flood in Louisiana or the earthquake in Haiti or something like that, where you go, okay, this is localized, and then they attack that group of people.
Mm-hmm.
This is not. This is global. So what we're seeing is that these attacks are happening all over to everyone, and they're very fear-based. So click here to download this app to see who has COVID in your area. That's a big one. They want to take over your phone. Emails coming from your work saying, hey, we need you to install this program to work from home, right? Then you like the phone calls where this is a huge thing. Think about it. People working in the office. Now you got mom, dad, and two kids all trying to find a place at home to work. So you're working from your bedroom, your kitchen table, somewhere else, and you're working more than you ever were before. Now you get a call, someone that says they're from IT. Hey, listen, we got to put a patch on your machine so you can connect to the VPNs while you're, you know, at home. And people will install programs. And this is how we're seeing major breaches occur. Phone, email, and SMS have gone through the roof. And now you add to that Verizon, T-Mobile, and AT&T have all been breached in the last 12 months. Your phone number's out there. My phone number's out there. This is why we're seeing an increase in phone calls and text messages all over.
Is there any are there blanket recommendations that take people out of having to make sort of like one-on-one decisions as frequently? Like, for example, I no longer pick up my phone at all unless I know exactly who's calling me. And it's for a bunch of different reasons, including that people who don't like me have found my phone number. But also because overwhelmingly, if I don't recognize the number, if it's a real call, they're going to leave a voicemail.
Yes.
And if it's not, I never hear back. So like that would be one thing that I do. Yeah. Are there other blanket things everybody can just make regular practices?
Yeah, these will seem a little technical, but I will say them just because I think that's a very important topic. First is I encourage everyone to use a password manager.
Mm.
Because the issue with the phone calls and stuff is eventually we're going to answer a call or we may fall for something. But if we use a password manager, then we don't have the same password on every website.
Yeah.
And they're easy to change and control. But even if you do that, the next thing is vitally important, and that's to use multi-factor authentication on everything that allows you. And if you have a choice, don't use the one that sends you a text message. Use the one that lets you use an app, you know, like Duo or Authy or Microsoft Authenticate or something like that, because that they need to have access to your physical phone in order to get that. And if they have that, you already have bigger problems, right? So those two things alone, and there's a ton of others, but those two things alone could save so many people. And then the third thing I'll say, and this is something that we can do for free in America, which is you could put a freeze on your credit with all three major credit bureaus.
Right.
And you can do that. You don't have to pay a service. It's easy. It takes 5 minutes, and you can unfreeze it in 5 minutes. And I suggest everyone do that, because if you have a password manager, multi-factor authentication, and your account is locked, people, even if they steal your data, they're not going to be able to use it. So that keeps you from having to worry, boy, did I just mess up? Did I give someone the wrong thing? And it can keep you nothing will keep you hacker-proof, but it could keep you relatively safe.
Now, in terms of just the incoming phone calls, is there sometimes you get legit phone calls because there really has been, you know, your credit card calls because there's a charge they want to confirm? Or I don't know if banks really call people frequently. My bank doesn't call me, but I'm guessing banks make phone calls sometimes for real. So is there some overarching principle that can be applied to any incoming phone call to prevent falling, even if it's 1 out of 1,000 that you fall for?
Yeah. So I do exactly what you said, which is I let them go to voicemail, even if it looks legit. Or if I do pick it up, and let's just say it's my bank, and they go, hey, this is your bank. We have some weird charges we need to verify.
Yeah.
I say, hey, I can't talk right now. I'll call you back. I do not call the number on the phone. I take my card out of my wallet. I call the toll-free number, and I say, hey, someone just called me from the bank saying there were some weird charges I need to verify.
Right.
Because I know that I'm talking to the real bank because I called you. But when you call me, I don't know. And if they just start trying to verify information, heck, man, with some of these breaches, they have all of that, so they can sound super legit.
Sure.
You know, so I just – and don't ever call a number they give you. Just yesterday, I had a friend of mine who got a call, someone saying they're from Amazon, and they were helping them try to complete a purchase on the account, and they needed them to install a program. They didn't fall for it, but they gave him a number, and he called the number back, and someone picked up, oh, Amazon, how can we help you?
Right.
So they even have people answering the phone with the, you know, the numbers that they're giving out. So you can't trust it if they give it to you. But if you call a legitimate number, then you can trust it.
Another one I've seen gotten recently is I'll get an email saying, hey, we just charged you $40 for the something you ordered. And of course, you go, I didn't order that. I got to go and get a refund. So then you look at the info on the email. And of course, if you called, my guess is they would say, oh, yeah, what was the credit card number you put it? And then you're off to the races.
Yeah. And if you think about that, sounds so legitimate, right? Because if I call into an actual vendor, like if I call my bank right now, they're going to say, please verify the account you're calling about.
Right.
They're not going to give me the account. They're going to ask me to verify it. So I'm going to legitimately give them my account number,
sure,
which could be my credit card. So if I call what I think is my bank and they go, hey, to look you up, we need to verify your identity. I need your full name, your account number, your social security. That sounds all legitimate.
Right.
So people will give it over. And what they don't know is that if you didn't initiate that call, there's no way for you to verify that you're speaking to the actual company, the actual person.
Right.
So I always say the best practice is you have to initiate the call Unless there's some solid proof, like, you know, you're standing, you're on the phone and they're verifying with you enough that you feel comfortable with that, or they're not asking you for personal details, I still really just, I'd rather just pick up the phone and call them back.
Agreed. We've been speaking with Chris Hadnagy, founder and CEO of Social Engineer LLC. The book is Human Hacking: Win Friends, Influence People, and Leave Them Better Off for Having Met You. Chris, always appreciate your time.
Thanks, David.
All right. I don't know if we call this an exercise in irony or an exercise in, I mean, listen, I don't know. Maybe if you believe in karma and these types of things, maybe that's the way you interpret this. But a Republican is going to be unable to attend an anti-vaccine rally because he now has COVID and is treating COVID with all sorts of unproven treatments. It's another one of these stories. This is being reported in the New York Daily News. A Republican lawmaker in North Dakota will miss his Monday rally opposing vaccine mandates because he has COVID. Instead, Representative Jeff Hoverson says he will stay home and take a cocktail of medications, including the unproven antiparasite drug ivermectin and the malaria remedy hydroxychloroquine. That's Jeff Hoverson showing a picture of him now. COVID is real and like a really bad flu, he wrote on Facebook. I am currently quarantining and each day is getting better. Hoverson claims that his home remedy, which is popular with right-wing pundits, a lot of right-wing pundits now give medical advice, it's interesting, should be more widely used by the public. He noted he's not hospitalized and he's on the mend. He posted to Facebook, thank you, brave soul, for getting me ivermectin, which now with COVID, I am able to stay out of the hospital. COVID is real and like a really bad flu. Quarantining and each day is getting better. Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, vitamins, etc., according to hundreds upon hundreds of medical experts, including in North Dakota, should be our early ambulatory care upon diagnosis. Give the kits, call and tell the state health department to stop misleading the public about these available treatments. Look for yourselves. Take your pick of experts, lists a number of people. Why is North Dakota providing cover for pharmaceuticals? We should be keeping people out of the hospital. It may not surprise you that this lawmaker is also a pastor. He told the Associated Press he tested positive last week for coronavirus. He said three of his teenage children will go to the anti-vaccine rally. He is a father of six. Hoverson has battled mask mandates, was barred from boarding a flight with his wife late last month because of an issue with a pat down, and said his wife, he and his wife were traveling for their anniversary. Imagine for a moment in the future explaining to people, you know, we had this pandemic and millions died, millions globally died, but then we got a vaccine and then there was a rally. There was a rally about the vaccine. Oh, and the rally was for people to get vaccinated, right? No. No, the rally was against vaccination. What? Imagine explaining it to a kid today. Imagine saying to, you know, little Sophie or little Mordechai, Dad, they're protesting for vaccines, right? No, they're not. But Dad, don't they want everybody to get vaccinated so that we end the pandemic? No, little Sophie. They want people not to get the vaccine. What? It's a very, very ugly episode in American history. And here's one guy who would have been at the protest, at the rally, but he's home with COVID, so he's not going to be able to do it. All right. Something really, really bad for our show happened yesterday. As many of you know, we have been covering every day of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And these are long days. We've been doing the show and streaming close to the full proceedings in court in Kenosha. I think it's an important case. I think it's an interesting case. Somewhere between 100,000 and 150,000 different people each day are checking out our coverage, which has been on YouTube, Twitch and Facebook. We have been banned by Twitch for 30 days and we have been banned by Twitch for 30 days for showing something which other channels also showed, including right-wing channels, which I'm not going to name because this isn't about getting other people in trouble.
That's something is that yesterday during the proceedings, during the testimony of an individual named Gage Grosskreutz, an exhibit was put up by the prosecution, which was about 8 or 10 seconds of video of Grosskreutz after being shot in the bicep. And his bicep is bloody. It is gory. And it was about 8 or 10 seconds of that. We believe because of immediate reporting by what we call antagonist watchers that watch my stream to Twitch, within about a minute or two, our account was suspended for 30 days. Now, the reason I say it was probably because of people immediately reporting us, we have a, you know, we have a close to 100,000 followers on Twitch. I don't, or we did. I don't think Twitch is watching our stream. And the fact that it happened so quickly and that other channels, including right-wing channels who showed the same video, have not been banned, suggests to me that was the reason. Now, this is, I'm not going to exaggerate, but I'm not going to downplay it. This is really bad for us. We've spent basically 2+ years since August of 2019 building our following on Twitch in my model of diversifying revenue streams, because we've seen YouTube will take away, you know, that who giveth sometimes taketh away. We've lost all of our YouTube revenue for periods of a couple months. We've had issues with Facebook, et cetera. Close to 100,000 followers. We had 1,000 paid members on Twitch. Because we are now suspended for a month, none of those 1,000 paid subscriptions will renew. For us, 1,000 paid members is a lot. What am I doing to try to fix this? First of all, let me say, I realize that those 8 to 10 seconds are against Twitch's guidelines on gore and playing violent videos, etc. We appealed the decision and said, we are not doing a stream of gore. We are not showing, you know, these kind of violence porn videos. We're showing a trial of newsworthy significance. We're 40 hours into this trial and there were 8 seconds of a gory video. It is not our intent to broadcast gore. And it there are video games with dogs being cut in half with chainsaws, which are allowed. Now, I get video games are different. It's not real. I would also argue that it's gratuitous and not newsworthy in video games. And I think it should be allowed, to be clear. I'm not attacking video games. I want to be really, really clear about that. But this is an important trial. We should be allowed to show it. And if you're going to ban us for it, you really have to ban everybody. And Twitch has not applied that even handedly. So we've appealed this to Twitch multiple times on different grounds. We've not heard back. I don't know whether that's likely to go anywhere. But this really isn't good. Now, I do want to address, there are people writing in and saying, David, you've been arguing in favor of platforms being allowed to do this. These are their terms of service and they're enforcing them. I'm not making any legal issue here. This is not a double standard. I stand by that. Twitch is allowed to have terms of service and to enforce them. Facebook is allowed to have terms of service and to enforce them. I just disagree with the enforcement. I'm not going out and saying this should be against the law. We've got to regulate Twitch. We've got to take away their power. I just think that they should reconsider how they enforce this on our channel, because it's both counterproductive to public education about an important trial. And our intent is not to be showing gory video after gory video. It was 8 seconds out of 40 hours that we have streamed of this. So for the people emailing me saying, this is what you get, David, for saying they should be able to enforce terms of service. No, they should. I'm just making the argument in my appeal that this was not the right decision with regard to my channel. If they say it was the right decision, I'm not going to say they should be sued. I just disagree with the decision that they made. So in the interim, I would like it if people decided to grab a membership on my website. These 1,000 paid members we lost on Twitch, it's really a big hit. It really is a big hit. So I would love it if you came over to joinpacman.com, grabbed a membership there. And I'm going to keep people posted as to what is going on. One last thing. I would love it if you respectfully contacted Twitch and said something along the lines of, please unsuspend David Pacman. His coverage of the trial is a public service or whatever, be polite, et cetera. I can't give you an email for who to contact. I've been told that in the past, when people have said email this email address at Twitch, Twitch considers that doxing because the person gave out an email. So I'm not going to tell you how to contact Twitch. figure it out on your own how to contact Twitch. It's not that difficult. And maybe lobby for our unsuspension. I would really appreciate that. I don't know what else we can do. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. I want to be clear. This is satire. This is not really anti-vax content. But here is a caller telling me about some really weird vaccine side effects that he got. This is funny.
Hi, Dave. I was just watching your episode about the unhinged anti-vax woman, you know, at the school board and her anti-Semitic rant. And I just want to go on record as saying I've had both the vaccine shots, both of Pfizer, early this summer, and I'm feeling great. Except maybe for picking up telepathic messages from the dark god Cthulhu, the ghost of H.P. Lovecraft. But that doesn't matter. I just put some tinfoil in my hat and I'm fine to go.
Exactly.
So just let everybody know there's no problem with the vaccine. It's working good. At least it is according to the ghost of H.P. Lovecraft.
Right. All right. Very good. Yeah, I'm actually going to be getting my third dose scheduled for later this week. I will report to you what symptoms I have. You know, it did happen that when I got my second dose, I did kind of trip on a curb and stub my toe on the way out. And so that, I don't know if I'm supposed to report that in the VAERS system, but it did take a couple days to heal and it sort of like chipped a little bit of my toenail. Okay, we've got a great bonus show for you today. We're going to talk about the right-wing hysteria over Big Bird and getting vaccinated. It's crazy. We will also talk about the Supreme Court, which will hear arguments on the FBI's surveillance of mosques. This is still a story. And we will talk about Philadelphia's ban on low-level traffic stops. What does that mean? What qualifies as low-level? All of those stories and much more on today's bonus show. Sign up and get instant access at...
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
O-U-R-C-T Radio 900.
Is Mark G of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way 40 hours every day.
Well, this is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh. You know, go Steelers.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. Yeah, that's where things like this go. Right down the drain.
Hi, we are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
This is Democracy Now!
What is 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature average? That is about 2 degrees plus for Africa and for many other places. So we mentioned that figure, it sounds something tolerable, that something that can be, you know, people can survive under it, but some people, is total sacrifice. It means you're actually sentencing people to death.
At the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, a draft agreement has been released urging nations to increase their pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions and phase out coal. But climate justice activists say the document falls far short of what's needed to avert a climate catastrophe. We'll speak to Nigerian environmental leader Nima Bassi. Then look at the Global Climate Wall, a new report examining how the world's wealthiest nations are prioritizing borders over climate action. Plus, we speak to the famed Indian writer Amitav Ghosh, author of the new book, The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis.
The climate crisis of today is rooted in centuries of geopolitical history that have created enormous disparities of power and wealth across the globe.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Glasgow, the UN Climate Agency released a draft accord today calling on countries to set more aggressive goals for cutting emissions and to fast-track the phasing out of coal as well as phasing out fossil fuel subsidies. The document also says countries should stop emitting greenhouse gases, quote, by or around mid-century, but does not set precise or urgent deadlines and enforcement policies. Negotiators at COP26 will continue talks over the second half of this week before a final deal is reached. This comes as the group Climate Action Tracker found the planet's on track to see a catastrophic 2.4 degrees Celsius rise in temperature this century, even with governments' pledges to reduce emissions. In other COP26 news, the foreign minister of Tuvalu recorded a speech to delegates delivered while standing knee-deep in seawater to highlight how the low-lying Pacific Island nation is facing imminent danger from rising sea levels.
We will not stand idly by as the water rises around us. We're not just talking in Tuvalu. We are mobilizing collective action at home, in our region, and on the international stage to secure our future. On the national level, we are pursuing bold legal avenues to ensure that Tuvalu's existing maritime boundaries will remain intact and we will be recognized as sovereign, even if our land territory is lost to climate change.
New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez arrived at the Glasgow summit, where she echoed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's message there that America is back when it comes to the global fight against climate change. But Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez added the U.S. has, quote, not recovered.